Hello, welcome to Journey of the Monkey King. As always, I'm Quiva, and I'm joined by my friend MJ.
Hello!
This is going to be another non-chapter reading episode. Previously in Chapter 9, we introduced the monk Xuan Zhang, and then we had a little bonus episode where I was on MJ's show, They Did What Now?, where we talked about the real Xuan Zhang. And polio. Yeah, you should go listen to the rest of that or watch the rest of that on Hysteria Network on Facebook. It's cool. Today, I just want to compare the two, the fictional and the real Xuan Zhang, because they are quite different. And especially I want to kind of focus in on Xuan Zhang's relationship with the Tang Dynasty and the Imperial and the Emperor and the Imperial system and everything.
Woo! Cultural context.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how, like, obviously that backstory about his family and the identity theft and the magic fish, obviously that's all fictional. But
I like to believe at least the bits about his mother were real, because, like, she was metal as fuck and I was here for it.
No, his dad died when he was like 11, not before he was born. Like, nothing resembles reality. Like, so much it doesn't resemble reality that in the novel, Xuan Zhang was born, or at least conceived, on the 13th year of Emperor Taizong's reign. He was the second Tang Emperor. In reality, the Tang Dynasty did not exist yet when he was born.
Okay, already a departure.
Yeah, so he was born under the Sui Dynasty, which collapsed when he was young. So when he was about 16 is when the Tang Dynasty started to exist.
Okay.
And the whole thing about the pilgrimage was that kind of why I thought it was a good candidate for that They Did What Now show is his pilgrimage was entirely his own volition and entirely his own want. So much so that he violated a ban on leaving the country to do it. It was explicitly illegal.
Yeah.
And
he needed those books, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I appreciate that a lot.
He really wanted damn book.
I don't know if I'd hop international borders to get to a bookshop, but I might have done so during lockdown when I had not been in a bookshop for quite some time. Other things I may have done to have that experience include, but are not limited to, selling an organ, selling someone else's organ, and just some various other things, perhaps, you know, slicing the skin off my arm and shoving it in salt water. You know, that really, really wanted that experience. I don't know. And
this podcast is going in a direction.
Hopping over international borders does sound a little bit easier than both of those things. So, but would involve leaving the house, which, again, we could not do.
Yeah, but the book really goes out of its way to change history to make sure that the pilgrimage is much more authorized. we haven't gotten to this in the book yet, but I don't think it's much of a spoiler. When Xuan Zhang does eventually go on his pilgrimage, it's ordained by Buddha, and Guanyin is kind of arranging everything, is how the plot happens. But it does end up being an official mission kind of declared by the emperor. It has official imperial approval. He's given, like, travel documents. He's basically given a passport by the emperor.
That was my next question. Was there a significant amount of paperwork?
Yeah, so they actually get, the translation is it calls it a travel rescript. But yeah, they basically just have a passport that they get stamped repeatedly throughout the story. There is,
oh my god,
There is repeatedly scenes of him having their passport stamped in each kingdom they go to, so that you can never forget how official and how legal this all is.
And yeah, the civil service is shining through here. I love that so much.
And they move the timeline of his birth up so that he can be born under the same emperor he returns in. So Taizong was emperor when the real Xuanzang returned to China. So they changed up the timeline so that he was the emperor when he was born. He's the emperor who like sends him on the journey then as well. And
Okay.
so they really, the author really, really went out of his way to change history to legitimize this journey, and make it nice and legal and nice and approved when the
Yeah.
real journey was not at all.
I imagine the real journey also did not feature a reanimated stone monkey. I'm
No.
not ruling it out. We weren't there.
No, although that's not an invention of the novel either. That's like the monkey disciple traveling with him is in older versions of the story as well. It's not unique to this novel at all.
Right, it's part of the original kind of folk tale or
Yeah.
our do I want to say an archetypal story? Because I mean, it is kind of like he's a trickster. He is the trickster archetype, but he's just very brazen in it. I'm trying to think of yeah, no, there are lots of scenes of him showing like the kind of classical trickster cunning type thing, the sort of I know more than you do, the I'm smaller than you and I'm going to use my guile to get one over on you. I'm thinking specifically back to the when he was in Immortality University, shall we say. Of course, like the difference between him and a lot of other trickster stories is not only in a lot of other trickster stories, you can see people see figures try and use their guile to gain power, but they're often thwarted and not successful. Whereas Sun Wukong is now like quadruple
Oh yeah,
immortal.
he's been wildly successful. He does get caught out eventually, but it takes escalating things all the way to Buddha to for that to happen.
We're going straight to the top.
Yeah, none of the bureaucracy or the Taoist gods were able to do anything about him.
Yeah, he does get his agency taken away and he is trapped and imprisoned, and which again is a theme of trickster gods. I mean, you
Yeah.
think back to Loki and the serpent. Serpent? Is it a serpent? I think it's a serpent, but the difference is he doesn't have his power stripped from him. He's just like he's too powerful and they lock him up. He
Yeah.
isn't humiliated to the same level.
Yeah, but
He's not having a good time,
he has
but
he
yeah,
he
no, it's
basically he
interesting that
basically ends up having his power forcibly turned to the side of good, I suppose, in that
okay.
he's made to be a companion for this monk on his pilgrimage.
Yeah. I mean, he's the kind of creature you want on your side. Or if only because you can keep an eye on him.
He makes a better friend than an enemy.
Yeah. I mean, if he's clearly not going anywhere, he might as well make himself useful and, just be kept an eye on.
But yeah, and he and it kind of just going back to the thing about the almost whitewashing of Xuanzang, he's kind of made to take part in this very lawful, very good pilgrimage ordained by Buddha as well. And like, I've lost my train of thought already, sorry. This is what happens when I don't have a script.
It's okay. You were saying that this is ordained by Buddha and it's good and lawful.
And that, I guess that's kind of the point of I guess that's kind of why the author felt the need to change history here. That the, everything about this pilgrimage has to be legitimate, and that doesn't just mean religiously legitimate. It also means legitimate under the state. So there's kind of a very running theme throughout the book of fealty and as well as piety and
Rule of law,
rule of law and submission to authority and submission to like father to like parents is are kind of conflated and kind of both good things.
That's really interesting because, what one of the things about Sun Wukong is he wasn't born to anyone. He hatched from literal stone.
Actually, I'd never thought of that. He has no parents, so
He doesn't have this sort of innate or ready-made authority figure that Jen Zhang would have.
yeah, that's a good point. I really never thought of that.
Three quarters of a BA in English.
Nice.
Yeah. Good for bullshit, not for much else. I've also probably gotten a ton of things about like trickster archetypes completely wrong, and I know we have the kind of audience that will school me on it. But yeah, filial piety and is that the word I'm looking for? And submission to authority are pretty big things. As opposed to, well, I mean the idea behind the pilgrimage that John Tsang made from my in real life from my understanding could either have been seen as trying to unite people around a single cause, which is either admirable one way you look at it, or slightly weird in terms of stifling debate and heading towards conformity.
Yeah, I feel like it's that general attitude of differences of opinions are just for lack of information.
Yeah,
That people don't
and there is one
genuinely have
uniting
different
truth.
good opinions, that people don't differ in their thinking, that
Yeah.
if we just had the right information, everyone would agree.
I mean, the other way of seeing it is going to insane lengths to avoid confrontation, which again, I have hidden behind tables. I literally dove behind a table at an art exhibition to avoid an uncomfortable conversation. So again, I can relate to that. Would I hop a border? Again, maybe not, but table diving. And the other thing is, people see what they want to see. So if you're avoiding conversations like that, you can be bold, just take the risk, hide behind the pot plant. Nobody expects you to be there.
Take the risk and hide.
Take the risk and hide, but hide in plain sight, hide in the weirdest places, hide in a cupboard. Nobody's gonna expect you to be in there. Nobody in their right mind would think, I bet I know where MJ is. Well, okay, people who know me probably would, but in general, nobody in that kind of social context, nobody expects you to be hiding behind the plant or behind the table. People see what they expect to see. The human mind is fallible. Go for it. That's all I can say. Live your dreams. Live your truth.
Usually I'd be trying to drag the conversation back to the script at this point, but I don't have a script this time, so yeah, just
No, you're
pot
in my
plants.
world now.
But yeah, I guess I can't, and the other problem is I can't remember whether I fully made a point or we went off track, but
Probably went off track. You were talking about
so the religious loyalty and the holiness of the journey is important. But that kind of can't be allowed to be in conflict with the earthly authority.
yeah.
And actually, in the next chapter, we'll kind of see that as well, where even a very godly being ends up being kind of subject to the Chinese emperor's authority,
See,
because.
I've got a question, because I have been warned off doing too much research into the cultural context behind this novel, so I've been just to keep me spoiler free and just reacting
Yeah,
with all to
not because
the
cultural context is bad, but just because spoilers.
just because it's more entertaining, frankly, if I'm coming in and kind of going, what the fuck, which has happened multiple times, and it's an experience I quite enjoy. So I'm kind of walking a fine line between, wanting to keep that vibe going and not wanting to kind of basically shit all over someone's culture due to lack of nuance and understanding. So, like, I have a question, if it's okay for me to know at this point, was the Tang Dynasty, or the Sui Dynasty quite theocratic? Was this a kind of a god emperor sort of situation?
I don't think so. I can't really answer very definitively, but I don't think that was again, my knowledge of history is not very good here, especially Chinese history. But my understanding is living emperors weren't necessarily ever seen as especially godly.
But
Like not,
they
not
were venerated in the kind of
yeah,
ancestor way once they died.
and with especially people like emperors that could basically turn into being a de facto god and be worshipped as one. Like we kind of discussed already with Laozi. It was a philosopher who basically ended up being deified, as well as Erlang and the Great Yu, who is meant to be the basically first founding the first dynasty of China after helping to control flooding, basically,
Yeah, which I
and
love.
is then then deified. So.
If you're going to deify anyone for anything, good civil engineering and urban planning.
Yeah, so I don't, but I don't think living emperors were like seen as infallible or having godlike authority. I think I might be very wrong on that, and I imagine exactly how the empress was seen probably changed in the changed probably changed over time in the thousands of years that China has existed.
This is true. This is very true.
But I think it's actually kind of more interesting in the other way, as we've kind of repeatedly shown in how bureaucratic and state-like the gods and heaven are. It's not I would say it's not even that the emperor might exert authority over spirits and gods because he is also godlike. It's more he is an emperor and he is an authority. And the gods and spirits operate in the exact same manner. And so, the Jade Emperor might would be, I suppose, above the Emperor of China, but they are both emperors.
Again, they have civil service grades,
Yeah.
which is just, I just love it. I just love so much that bureaucracy is such a big part of the heavenly experience. I'm not entirely sure why, but I don't know, maybe it's that I like things to have proper procedures that you can go through, which is probably an autistic thing, to be quite honest. But yeah, no, I really like that part of the novel, and I'm just delighted whenever, you have to show paperwork to a supernatural being. Maybe it's how prominent just writing and the act of having written information is in in this thing that was, built on a folk tale.
Yeah.
Something about that just appeals to me.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to writing in China having been a lot more common for a lot longer.
Yeah, and the kind of I love as well that mostly, writing appears to have developed in most places, not as a sort of I must express myself or I must leave a note to someone to kind of say, yeah, actually that plant that I just ate, not a good idea. Don't eat that
Oh
plant.
no, it's who
But
owes me money?
as a way to organize society, yeah, as taxation and a way to organize society, and I love that concept. I love how it's such a practical thing that develops, which is then put to artistic use once someone gets their hands on it. I really like that. It kind of appeals to me, I guess, on a philosophical level that this mundane thing is then turned into something beautiful. It's like we can't help ourselves. Like as soon as we get this organizational system, we have to create something from it.
It makes me wonder, the kind of other way around, kind of in, societies with a more oral tradition, did people like, as because, epics and poetry and all that are basically a way to pass down stories that's in a way that's much more memorable,
Yeah.
than plain speech. So
This is yeah. I'm not trying to say that before writing there was no stories
Oh
or
no,
anything.
I
I
know.
guess
That's
just to
not where I'm
commit
going
it
with
to
either.
memory. It's used for stories. It feels like we can't be given something without eventually using it for stories.
But I just kind of wonder, like, was the format of epics and that kind of thing put to practical use as well in to organize things of like, was there a poem of who was were there epics people composed to lay down and remember who in this kingdom owned what and who reported to who and all of these kind of things.
Well, a lot of them are kind of not exact, a little bit didactic in the sense that their epics in a lot of ways are rules for society to live by, and an example of if you follow these rules and if you embody these values, good things are going to happen to you. And if you embody these values, then you're fucked. And clearly this guy, he's gone to great lengths to legitimize the pilgrim's journey. Clearly this guy seems to be very much, if you participate in this system that was designed by authorities, earthly and otherwise, to serve the collective good, then, or, well, not always, and not a lot, maintain systems of power, let's be frank, but in most cases, but the propaganda there is maintain the collective good. Then you're going to be great. You're going to be fine. And if you don't, you're going to end up being tortured in a brazier under a mountain for 500 years. So, get to it. Get to, putting your nose down and doing your thing.
Yeah, one thing that stuck out to me just in talking about how the epics and that kind of format was also kind of lessons for expected behavior and morality is one thing that stuck out to me when I read the Odyssey was the aside about how you should treat homeless people basically, where like the squatters in Odysseus's house are judged extremely harshly for not taking in Odysseus disguised as a homeless man as a guest,
Yeah.
and they goes on a little thing about how like there's no one worse off than a homeless person, so you should always give them shelter and such.
Yeah, and my understanding is the Greeks, and this is I'm not a classics person. I know this almost purely just from talking to Ian Lynham, who does Hades and Gentlemen on Hysteria, which is
I've read the Odyssey and nothing else, so
But my understanding is that you know, the Greeks had lots of rules among around hospitality and how you are supposed to treat guests, and that I find quite interesting. But another thing I'm interested in about epics, and this is obviously this isn't news to everyone, but I think my first special interest as an autistic person was language. I read the dictionary quite a bit as a child, and still, for some reason, was not diagnosed till my 20s. And it's a facepalm moment for me, I'm not going to lie. But around the age of like 6 or 7, I became really fascinated with how words had different meanings, even when they're synonyms. There were shades, there were nuances. And as a very naive child, I kind of went, oh, yes, this will solve the problem of me not making myself understood. And I was like, no, this is how you get hit a lot. But obviously that, again, this is not news to people, but it's just kind of a background of my fascination. Translation is so important in how these stories are presented, and you're inevitably going to lose a lot of context that way when you're translating from a language that's from a culture that's completely foreign to you and has completely different rules. Inevitably, you're going to lose some of the story, because I remember you talking about reading the Odyssey, and you'd read a translation, one of the first ones out there by a woman.
In English, I think there were other translations,
yeah,
in other languages.
In English, sorry.
Yeah.
And again, I'm getting so much of this wrong. But I remember you kind of talking about how different it was to the male translation. So I think even the act of translating imposes a foreign set of values on a story, which is quite interesting when we're talking about epics that are, you know, I don't know if didactic is the way is the word I'm looking for here, but certainly set up to deliver moral instruction to a society. That's just something. And even if we were reading it in the ancient Greek, we would have been, you know, either kind of translating it in your head, or you'd learned ancient Greek from someone who'd, because, you know, maybe it's different if we were reading it in modern Chinese, for example, where, mm-hmm. You know, society has obviously changed a lot, but it's still very different from Western culture in the sense that it's more collectivist than individualistic. So I wonder what that is. I'd love to also kind of talk to a Chinese person about what they get from the story, or a native Chinese speaker.
Yeah.
Anyway, and just kind of see what the differences are there.
Yeah. The translation of the Odyssey, by the way, was by Emily Wilson. And she has some notes in the intro for that book about her translation versus kind of other translations that there have been through the years, and you can find a few articles and interviews with her talking about it as well. They're all really interesting. Even talking about like the very first sentence, where there's a word that's used that's what's the word for it? It's a word that basically only exists in the first line of the Odyssey.
I have absolutely no idea. Remember it being a very interesting conversation with you, and
yeah.
some very key differences.
Yeah, I think she had a whole a bit about just translating that first sentence, because there's a word used to describe Odysseus that I think the Greek, it was basically the original word is basically a compound word of like many and turns or something like that. And there's like apparently so many different translations of that word and interpretations, so of like people thinking it means maybe skillful or like you know, multi-talented, and lots of different stuff, and she translated it as complicated.
I love that.
And then other things like just how kind of little subtle things about how like the bit with the sirens is translated, and what words are used The word for a lot of men have translated and replaced the words mouth. There's like the sirens talk about like the words from their mouths, and a lot of men change it to lips in translation. Slightly
It
sexier.
just sounds more erotic.
Yeah. Also, sirens are like giant bird women. I'm not even sure they'd have like sirens like originally as depicted weren't mermaids. They were like giant bird women things. Not even sure they'd have lips.
I'm not sure why it changed then to mermaids. I'm not what happened there?
No idea. And I'm rambling off Wikipedia articles and shit, so like don't take me as a source on anything.
No, I'm not gonna lie, this my side of this episode has been, at least 20% recollection, 10% being quite sincere about my interests, and 70% utter bullshit.
Yeah, that's fine.
This is
This
fine.
is it's fine.
This is okay. It's all right to have a scriptless episode every now and then. We had to take a break recently because we were both very tired. We continue to be very tired, but slightly less.
So yeah, I think that's, I think we've covered everything I wanted to talk about with the difference between real and fictional Xuanzang, and kind of just we can bring it up as things go in the actual show now, but I kind of wanted to air that, and I meant to make a bigger deal of the fact that the book is actually like based on a real person, because I think that's really funny when you're like reading eight chapters about this magic talking monkey and then you're like, oh yeah, by the way, this is based on a true story. But sadly MJ found this out before I got to tell them.
I did go searching for a little bit of cultural context because, again, I just don't want to be racist. That's I just don't. I would rather not be horrendously racist if I can help it.
That's a reasonable goal in life.
I've no doubt that I have been racist during this podcast and have a lot to learn, and I am very, very much a white person.
Oh yeah, and I'm spouting off about shit about like how I think emperors in China were perceived as if I have any fucking idea.
I'm taking your word
Oh,
for
don't.
it
Please
because
don't. Please
you just
don't.
sound very informed, and I'm
I'm
just quite,
not.
yeah.
Please don't take my word on anything. Just listen to this podcast and think it's funny, but just go actually read the book and everything yourself. Don't trust me.
I'm very confident that you know exactly what you're talking about when it comes to units of measurement.
Thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
I guess that's it. So
Yep. Social media handles in the show notes. I've already plugged most of what's on Hysteria. Go and have a dig. I think if you like this podcast, you'll particularly love Hades and Gentlemen. But there's other really cool stuff on there as well.
we should either like have a sign-off thing we do, or else just like pre-record something.
Yeah, probably, but I'm okay with this. We are imperfect people, as we have just discussed, and one of our flaws that we will probably get around to working on at some stage. Personally, I have many, many flaws that require more urgent attention, as you may have been able to guess by the lengths I would go to avoid confrontation. But I will probably work on my ability to possibly sign off a show eventually.
Yeah, well, I think the real problem is neither of us know how to shut up.
True. This is very true. We are rambly, rambly people.
Requiring a moment where we actually have to stop talking.
Rambly is not a word either, but the language evolves and is beautiful for it. And I have decided it is a word. It may enter the popular lexicon. It probably won't. I don't have that kind of cultural cachet, but I will use it because I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Rambly.
Ramble, ramble, ramble. Rambly rambles.
Okay. Signing off now.
Bye.